Everywhere I see bathing establishments, spas and medicinal baths making use of water for all kinds of cures and treatments, salt water baths, marsh baths, hot and cold baths, compresses, and many other applications of water for the curing of physical ills. People even take advantage of the healing power in dew by walking about barefoot in the wet grass. Then towards the end of this era, when the vernal point approaches the next constellation, that of the water bearer, people make technical discoveries and inventions based on wave energies. This is one of the early effects of the budding water bearer era, an age of technical achievement. The radiation of the water bearer constellation, which knows no limitations and sweeps all obstacles out of its path, reveals itself in the ideas and social concepts of humanity. At the end of the era of the fishes, these new energies cause great revolutions in the places where people react most powerfully to them. I see thousands of people of the ruling class sitting in prison, while a spirit with the characteristics of a new coming era decapitates or otherwise kills countless people of the upper class. A vision from the time when the energies of the water bearer are working with full power shows me that the great teacher of this epoch abolishes all the boundaries between the three dominant religions. With his own person, he proves that the inner core of all religions is one and the same truth, one and the same God. The boundary between religion and science disappears too, as people discover that everything, even matter, is a wave movement. They learn that the only differences between manifestations of the spirit and those of matter are differences of frequency, while in its essence everything is only the manifestation of the one, single, prime source of all forces, God. Everything is a wave, just as the symbolic representation of the water bearer constellation shows, a supernal being pouring waves out of his pitcher. The spiritual movements on the earth show this effect. Science discovers the wave theory, and I see countless inventions based on waves. I see pictures of people, landscapes and objects, pictures made by the effect of light waves. I see different kinds of devices which send out waves. Waves penetrate matter and reveal its solidity. There are waves that show what elements are present in the matter of the planets and fixed stars, electric waves, waves of sound, light and smell. Medical science has stopped giving treatments with water in favor of treatments based on waves. All kinds of waves, from infrared to ultraviolet, short waves and still shorter waves, even more penetrating waves and frequencies. All in use by science. The constellation of the water bearer belongs to the airy face of God. And mankind conquers the air, with energies won from matter in the airy state. I see people moved onward from the steam engine to other machines operated by gas. And then my astonished eyes follow huge locusts high up in the air, made by human hands and carrying people in their bellies. These machines are powered by gas, air conquers air. Through the complementary sign of the lion, people again recognize the strongest manifestation of God on earth. The sun, the great Ra, is again acknowledged as the prime source of all manifestation of earthly energy. Once more people have become sun worshippers, even though not in a religious sense. The influence of the lion shows itself in another plane too. The effect of the water bearer is to abolish all boundaries, all limitations. But the absence of boundaries without a concentrating midpoint means mental disease, spiritual death. The boundlessness of the water bearer would affect the unconscious masses as a mental illness running throughout all humanity, causing anarchy and chaos, and destroying everything. Through the complementary sign of the lion, however, dominion is concentrated in individual persons, dictators who group the people about themselves and guide them. In this epoch, people discover traffic and intercourse with other planets. Boundaries and obstacles disappear, and with them the isolated state of the Earth in cosmic space. And as the boundaries between countries disappear too, all humanity is governed from one center. One stable, one shepherd. The eternal wheels roll on, and the Earth moves into a new epoch, under the sign of the goat and its complementary constellation, the crab. People direct their attention to the earth again, noticing that although their knowledge may be very great, they still know very little about their own marvelous mother, Mother Earth. In this epoch they solve the problem of conquering Earth. The sign of the goat belongs to the earthly face of God. People design a special machine based on the same principle as that of our Ark of the Covenant. With it, they controlled the weight of matter. That is, they can overcome the Earth's gravitational pull, or through ultramaterial radiations, they can vastly increase it. People communicate with each other directly through the Earth, in the depths of the mountains, in short straight lines, instead of taking the long way around the Earth. This new machine of theirs radiates an energy which dematerializes everything in front of it, thus moving forward quickly, freely, without let or hindrance. At the same time it spews out condensing and solidifying radiations behind it, restoring the matter of the Earth to its original condition. People have conquered matter, with the energy of ultramatter. This enables them to penetrate into the depths of the Earth and harness for the service of mankind the enormous forces and energies raging there like primordial volcanoes. The combination of the two zodiacal signs of the goat and the crab has a strong influence on the spiritual life of mankind. The great teacher of this epoch reveals unto man the mystery of the immeasurable sources of power hidden in the depths of the human soul. Those who hold the key to these sources of power possess abilities which the ignorant call supernatural. All over the earth I see public schools where even little children are taught to attain these higher abilities through the kind of exercises which only candidates for the priesthood are permitted to practice in our temples. This high and wonderful knowledge spreads into ever greater circles, reaching ever greater numbers of people. The visions suddenly pale as I come back to normal consciousness. Still lying on the couch, I'm almost dizzy from the tremendous experiences of the future. Tahotep stands in front of me and helps me get up. He ends his instructions for today: "As you see, my child, the inhabitants of the earth receive their initiation in small groups and then in larger and larger ones, all interrelated one with the other. A person can be initiated individually within his own lifetime, and a nation can receive initiation if it works its way up to the highest level of development and fulfills its task here on Earth. Eventually the whole world will receive initiation by completing the full circle of the four faces of God, experiencing step by step all stages of initiation in a systematic development, and finally achieving complete spiritualization, salvation from matter. Measured according to earthly time standards, it will take ages and ages for this development to be achieved. For countless times the earth will have to go through the zodiacal circle, both in terrestrial and cosmic years. I've shown you only the tiniest part of this exceedingly long path of development. The history of mankind on earth is not a matter of accident or happenstance. It's important for you to know that every step of development takes place according to divine providence, following a divine plan. A person can cover this infinitely long way in a single lifetime if he concentrates his will exclusively on this goal. As he gives me his benediction, Tahotep says, "Come back again tomorrow, I have important things to tell you." Final preparations. The next day I can hardly wait till evening to report to Tahotep. On the other hand, I've made enough progress in self-control for me not to let the reins slip out of my hand regardless of any amount of pressure external things may be exerting upon me. Fully conscious, I observe how external events affect my nerve centers, and I simply refuse to let my nerves get stirred up when I don't want them to. The moment their natural reaction begins, I move in with my consciousness between them and the action they have begun to take, and I consciously command my entire nervous system to become as calm and cool as a piece of steel. But now, after Tahotep has told me he has something important to say, I can scarcely keep my heart from beating faster every time I think about it, and I think about it often. Evening comes at last, and I walk through the long colonnade to his little reception room. Fully composed, I stand before him again. Tahotep receives me as he always does. His noble face radiates something indescribably exalted, and so I have no way of knowing whether he has something special in mind. "My little daughter," he begins, "you've progressed to the point that the ability of your mind to control all the natural forces in your body has been made completely conscious. From now on, it depends on your own will whether you give expression to a force or not. Neither in your mind nor in your soul nor in your body are you any longer a slave of nature. But I must point out to you that there still exists the possibility of your becoming a slave again. If you consciously apply your will, nobody and nothing can keep you from preserving your freedom. Or from allowing yourself to be enslaved again by the forces arising from your own self. It is God's will, and therefore a law, that every spirit has complete freedom of will. No one may violate this freedom. That's why you should never stop exercising constant self-control and self-analysis. You are now ripe for initiation. But remember that the omniscience and the omnipotence conferred upon you by initiation includes commensurate responsibility. Carefully and thoughtfully, you must now finally decide whether you want to be initiated and, through initiation, take tremendous responsibility upon yourself. Stay home for 3 days and practice complete silence. If you are still determined to go through with initiation, your father will accompany you here on the 4th day, the day of the new moon, so that you can make your final preparations. I would like to tell him that I am already determined, but I notice that he is perfectly aware of my determination. Nevertheless, the regulations must be observed, so I bow again and leave. I use the 3 days first and foremost to take leave of everything to which I am personally attached. I know I'll be a completely different person when I come home from the temple as an initiate. I wander about the garden again where once I walked with my mother among the flowers. I seek out all the favorite spots of my childhood where I used to play and later dreamed about life and what it would be like. In all these places I stand for a time in silence, taking leave of each tree and each flower, and simultaneously taking leave of the little girl who once was so happy here. Then I visit the goldfishes in the great pond. I used to feed them when I was so small I could hardly walk, and a slender, delicate person dressed in white took me by the hand to keep me from falling into the water. Today again, I feel this fine, white, ethereal being near me. We are still closely attached, and I know that according to the laws of incarnation, just as she, like a door between the other world and this, helped me to be born, she will help me on again from this world over into the next. At last I come to the court of lions where I take leave of my favorite lions. Until I am initiated, I am only permitted into the court in the presence of the keeper. Today he accompanies me for the last time. As an initiate I too will have power over all animals and will no longer need his protection. Only the lions used by the ruling family are kept here. One of them is the magnificent animal that always sits beside my father during his audiences as a symbol of his superhuman power. Then there are the lions that pull our chariot, and finally my own two animals, Shuga and Shima. Both of them were sired by the lion my father has with him in his audiences. They're both equally intelligent, hypersensitive, wonderful examples of their race. Both of them love me just as if I were a lioness rather than a woman. Shuga in particular is crazy about me and gets excited and jealous whenever I stroke Shima. I have to watch out that his love doesn't turn into blind and jealous rage. This would be dangerous. As I enter the court, Shuga runs over to meet me and pokes his mighty head under my arm as an invitation for me to scratch his neck and ears and stroke his mane. Then, as usual, he tries to lick my face while I dodge as deftly as possible so as not to offend him and make him angry. I hand him a piece of warm meat, and while he devours it I get a moment to pat Shima and give him a piece of meat too. On the 3rd and last day father and I go out before sundown for a chariot ride with our lions. We race about with tremendous pleasure. In accordance with Tahotep's instructions, I am not allowed to speak, but even without this commandment, we wouldn't be talking anyway. We understand each other without words. truth is like an invisible man. He can only make himself visible by putting on clothes. If he puts on a lot of clothes that fit loosely, we get only a very imperfect picture of him. The less he wears, the thinner and tighter his clothing is, the more exact the impression we get of him. But regardless of how well his clothing may reveal his shape, it still covers him, and we see only the clothing but never the invisible person himself. It's exactly the same way with truth. The less words we use to express truth, that is, to cover it and make it visible, the better we can recognize it. But by the mere fact of expressing truth in words, covering it with words, we simultaneously keep ourselves from seeing truth itself in its immediacy, its nakedness, its true being. For people who cannot succumb into each other's minds, words are the only means of communication they possess. But they never see what the other is thinking and would like to say only words about it. But we, Father and I, see each other. Why should we cover our thoughts and our souls with words? We are here for each other and enjoy the unity of existence. The lions race ahead. We ride in silence. We both know what these last days mean. Early in the morning of the great day I take leave of Menu and Bergar. Menu cries as hopelessly as if I were going to my own funeral. She has baleful forebodings of something terrible to come. There's simply no way I can console her. Little Bogar has no idea what's happening, but he cries bitterly too because he sees me going away and because Menu is crying. As I start to embrace him, he throws himself on his knees before me and puts his arms about my feet. From the very deepest depths of his soul, he cries out, "Oh Queen, my dear Queen, don't forget what I swear unto you now. Any time, any place you are in danger, I'll save you. Even if I am at the other end of the earth, I'll come to you. Remember, as God is my witness, I'll save you. Dear little Bergar. He'll save me. But what from? If Tahotep finds me prepared and ready for initiation, how could I get into danger? And why is the boy saying that he would even come from the other end of the earth to save me? He's here with me now, how could he possibly go so far away? But I can't think about his words, for the time has come. I embrace them both, then walk over to my father's chambers. Father receives me with a sad and earnest expression, and I see that he is withdrawn and deep within himself. Does he too see something baleful and forbidding in my future? He embraces me, lovingly places his right hand upon my head, and blesses me. Then we go. Tahotep awaits us in his little reception room. Before we enter, Amma appears for a moment in the long colonnade. His angelic face is beaming, his eyes smile at me with encouragement, and then he's gone again. I know that his love too will be accompanying me in the difficult, challenging hours ahead. Father takes me up to Tahotep. He takes my hand and puts it into Tahotep's hand. Once again he gives me a loving look and then leaves the room. My dear daughter, says Tahotep, a great circle of the law in which your destiny manifests itself in the world of time and space is closing today. This circle, your earthly career, was already determined and set the very moment you fell out of divine unity for the first time, just as a boomerang, at the moment it's thrown, has within itself the forces that determine the kind of circle it will make, how high it will rise, how much time its flight will consume, and when it will return to its starting point. Your present character and your destiny were built up by the same forces. Both of them are the result of cause and effect, actions and reactions, deeds and experiences through countless lives in which the self has manifested itself throughout ages and ages of time. All these actions and reactions, deeds and experiences have crystallized out in your present person and character. Your character determines your destiny and consequently your future. The self radiates its creative forces through the sieve of the character into the incarnation, and through picture-making forces in the depths of the soul. These energies create dream pictures. These latter project themselves outwardly into the material world where they manifest themselves as your person and your destiny. The self radiates into every human being the same creative forces. The fact that so many different dream pictures and so many different persons and destinies arise from these same creative forces is the result of the different influences to which people have been exposed since their fall from paradisiacal unity. Whether the future projections of the self which have not yet materialized but are still waiting for materialization in the depths of the soul, in the subconscious, become realities on the material plane or whether they merely remain dream pictures depends on the plane with which man identifies his consciousness. A dream is also reality, only in the immaterial, picture-making energy world, while what happens on earth and what people call reality is also only a dream, a projection of the self, the only difference being that it is a lower projection, working into the material plane, and visualized into the atmosphere of the earth. Destiny is thus an incarnated projection of the future, a materialized dream. As long as a person allows the will of his self, the will of God, to rule, what happens on the material plane, in the so-called reality, is what he himself consciously wants. Consequently, he is also in control of his destiny. This is because a person's self has the power to take those dreams of his which are waiting in his subconscious for materialization and transform them into spiritual energy. On the other hand, the moment a person identifies himself with extraneous forces which are rising, not from within his self, but from within his lower nature, his body, and the moment he recognizes these forces as his own will, what happens is no longer what he himself wants but what his body wants, even though he may be fully convinced that this is his own will. In this way he loses control over his destiny and is completely at the mercy of the blind forces of fate. In this case, the dream pictures and projections lying latent in his subconscious unavoidably and with absolute certainty turn into real events on the earthly plane. In your initiation, before you reawaken out of your physical consciousness into the divine cosmic self-consciousness, the energies which you have created through your deeds and their reactions throughout ages and ages of time and which are now waiting in your subconscious for the time of their materialization, like seeds of future events, will appear in your consciousness as dreams. You can't destroy them because they come forth out of creative forces. But you can prevent these energies from coming down and turning into reality on the level of the material world. You can do this if you yourself, with your consciousness, go down into the depths of your soul, where these forces are hiding in a latent state, and if you awaken them to life in your consciousness and experience these dreams yourself as full reality. To experience means that you draw the forces that have been sent out back into your consciousness and live them as states of consciousness. In this way the inner tension within the forces is dissolved away. The energies then fade away, lose their power, and are destroyed. In your initiation you will experience your whole future destiny as a series of different states of consciousness, as dream pictures, without being conscious of either time or space. In this way you will become liberated from your person and thus from your own personal fate. You will continue to use your body as an absolutely impersonal instrument of God. This is because every initiate has the duty of continuing to work on earth in order to help other people out of the fetters of matter, out of the fetters of the body, out of the claws of blind fate, back into the divinely spiritual state of unity. Everything and everyone that has fallen into separation and into matter by virtue of becoming incarnated must find its way back home to the lost paradise, back to the divine state of unity. But when an initiate works in the opposite direction, that is, when he uses his high spiritual energies to create personal realities for himself by directing the supreme, creative, all-penetrating forces from his divine consciousness into his body, he falls lower than an ordinary person who does the very same thing with his consciousness that has fallen out of the paradisiacal unity. The ordinary person directs into matter only the forces arising from his material being. He experiences physical forces in his body, and for him this doesn't represent a fall. He manifests forces on the level from which they come. Material forces remain on the material level. The initiate, on the other hand, isn't just working with physical forces, and when he directs his high spiritual energies into the body, He falls from his high state and falls down low. The higher the energy, the lower he falls. That's why you have to remember that as an initiate, if you want to become one, you can't do things that ordinary people can do with impunity, because as an initiate you radiate and set in motion divine forces, not human ones. If you direct these forces into your body, you burn out your nerve centers and plunge into the lowest depths like a falling comet. Your preparatory exercises have developed you to the point that you can understand these truths. So now, in full consciousness, you can give me your answer. Have you the courage to take upon yourself these laws, the danger and the great responsibility? Do you desire to receive initiation, or do you wish rather to withdraw and live out your earthly life according to the laws of human existence? For a time I keep silent. Then, earnest and determined, I reply, Father of my soul, throughout the years I've been preparing, I've had enough time to decide whether I wanted to choose the temple or a worldly life. And during these last 3 days I've concentrated again on this question and on nothing else. My only longing is for the divine, primordial state. I am absolutely determined. I beg you to initiate me. So be it, says Tahotep, and may God be with you. Now follow me. He takes me to another wing of the temple where the neophytes live. There he turns me over to a young priest, a chief among the boarders, who is awaiting us. I have seen him before. Turning to me, Tahotep says, You will now prepare your body and your soul for initiation. On the day when the moon reaches its fullness, come to me at sundown. We both of us bow, and he departs. The priest leads me to a cell where I spend the next few days alone, devoting myself exclusively to my exercises. The purpose of these exercises is to bring the purity of my thoughts, my soul, blood and body up to as high a point as possible. Even during the years when I was going to the neophyte school, I had to follow a very strict dietary regimen, in order for the new cells constantly being produced in the body to be chemically purer than those they replaced, and in order for my body tissues to develop resistance enough to be able to bear the highest vibrations. This is because any chemical change in matter alters its resistance to the forces conducted into it. Now the process reaches completion. I am permitted to eat only certain special roots and herbs. I have to chew them thoroughly, and I am permitted only to swallow the juice I can chew out of them. These herbs and roots are so chosen that some of them tend to strengthen and stimulate the organs of excretion, while others have a similar effect on the heart and nerves, so that my whole organism is not weakened. As a result of this new dietary discipline, I feel lighter and lighter with each passing day. Within a few days' time, I even feel as if I didn't have a body at all. On the other hand, my mental lucidity and ability to concentrate increase to a degree I have never known before. In all my life I have never been able to think so clearly. Never been able to perceive spiritual truth with such pristine crystal clarity as now. By mere fasting alone, without the use of strengthening herbs, one can also reach a high degree of mental clarity. But the nerves can suffer damage in the process. Although they become hypersensitive during fasting, they are greatly weakened at the same time. Through the use of these herbs, all the disadvantages of fasting are eliminated. One by one the days go by, until the day of the full moon comes. Withdrawn deeply inside myself, I go forth to report to Tahotep. I enter just as the sun is disappearing below the horizon. Follow me, says Tahotep, and leads the way out. Tahotep takes me through the temple around the sacrificial table and on over to the great stone wall. The gigantic stone blocks fit together with hairline precision. Now I know why. Tahotep steps over to the middle one, which slowly swings outward, revealing an opening in the wall. Beyond it lies a broad stone staircase leading downward. We go down to the bottom of the steps, then follow a long passageway. My sense of direction and a certain feeling in my lungs tell me we are walking under the ground. Surprisingly enough, however, there is no mold or mildew, and the air is fresh and pure, with even a scent of ozone in it. At the end of this subterranean passageway, We reach another staircase, leading upward. After we've climbed it, Tahotep leads me through more passageways, some wide, some narrow. We walk through rooms of various sizes containing strange and incomprehensible apparatus, then climb up more steps. Finally, we enter a large room.